to be here. So I'm going to tell you something about the electrovic stars whose existence we recently proposed. So this is talk based on this work done in collaboration with Dechang Dai, who is my postdoc at Sunny at Buffalo, Arthur Liu, that's our colleague from MIT, and Glenn Starkman from Case Western Reserve University. So what's the motivation for this work? Well, we know that stellar evolution is one of the most interesting questions in modern astrophysics, but despite tremendous progress in this field, it looks like it's far from being closed. More or less everybody agrees about a conventional evolution from a protostar to a neutron star, but recently we have some new exotic stages proposed, like quark star, prion star, dark star, grava star, boson star, and so on. But somehow people missed the most obvious extension, electrovic star, whose existence doesn't depend on some exotic physics. It depends only on the physics that we all know and understand. So this is the outline of the talk. So after a brief overview in which I will remind you... No, it's crystal graphics. It's some extra software. I can give you the software if you want. No problem. So this is the outline. After a brief overview, where I will remind you about the basic stuff about the stellar evolution from a protostar to a neutron star and quark star, I will dedicate most of my time answering the question, can electrovic stars powered by baryon number violating processes exist in principle? In particular, can a star's core be compressed to electrovic densities without being within its own Schwarzschild radius? And can this new phase of evolution last long enough to be called a star? And the answer will be perhaps yes. So, if we ignore an elephant in a room that we call dark matter, our universe is filled with clouds of dust and gas. So we have 71% of hydrogen, 27% of helium, and 2% of everything else. And in some places, these nebulae are dense enough that gravity pulls them together strongly, then their natural expansion tries to move them apart. And these will eventually collapse to become stars. In a protostar stage, gases being pulled together by gravity accelerate as they fall inwards. Then they crash into the other gases that have accumulated at the center, and this causes the central baby star, called the protostar, to be very hot. So even protostar is very hot. At certain moment, the core gets hot enough for nuclear fusion to commence, and we call it a protostar as long as gases are still falling inwards onto it. And this stage can last about a few million years. And then the main sequence stars is powered only by nuclear fusion in an equilibrium with gravity, so we don't have any new material falling onto it. So this is the diagram. A clump of gas becomes a protostar when radiation can no longer escape from the interior. Protostar shrinks and heats as gravitational potential energy is converted into thermal energy. Thermonuclear reactions start. Fusion rate increases until gravitational equilibrium stabilizes the star. Where a star ends up on a main sequence is determined by its mass. For example, so the collapse of larger clouds takes less time than the collapse of smaller clouds. For example, 15 solar mass cloud collapses in about 60,000 years. 0.5 solar masses cloud collapses in 150 million years, and then star ends up on this Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, its HR diagram, which is just luminosity versus surface temperature of the star. What is the mass range of these stars? So the most massive mass, a star that we can imagine is about 100 solar masses because larger stars cannot form because of the solar wind, which is generated by the first 100 solar masses, will push away other gases rather than allowing them to join the star. The smallest star is around 0.1 solar mass, any smaller than that, and the core never gets hot and dense enough for nuclear fusion to begin. A star's lifetime depends on two things: energy reservoir, available energy, which is just proportional to its mass, and the luminosity, which is proportional to m to the 3.5. If you divide these two numbers, you get 1 over m to 2.5, which means that massive stars live shorter. For example, 40 solar mass star lives about 1 million years. 0.5 solar mass star lives about 56 billion years. Stellar models actually show how stars change. So star moves on the HR diagram in three ways. First, evolution onto the main sequence. That's the birth of the star. That's the diagram that I just showed you a couple of minutes ago. Evolution on the main sequence. That's the life of the star. And evolution off the main sequence is a dying star. For 90% of the star's life, we have fusion of hydrogen into helium in the core in a reaction that we call a PP chain, in which several protons ends up being a nuclear of helium. During that time, star doesn't move much on HR diagram, and changes are very small during the lifetime. So good news, main sequence stars are very boring. Why is this good news? Because we live on a planet orbiting a main sequence star. We want that star to do exactly the same thing every day without anything new and exciting. As ancient Chinese curse says, may you live in interesting times. So interesting times is when the star leaves the main sequence and becomes a red giant. So hydrogen in the core gradually gets used up. Helium ash accumulates at the core, but it's still not burning. Hydrogen burns vigorously in a shell outside of the core. Luminosity goes up, envelope swells, and we have a red giant. Tiny core, but huge envelope. In the context of our star, Sun, that will represent the end of life on Earth. So in about 4 to 5 billion years, our star will become a red giant that will encompass Earth's orbit. That will be the end of it. But what's the next stage? The next stage is helium ignition. So the hydrogen shell dumps more and more helium ash onto the core. Core grows and heats, and when temperature exceeds 120 million degrees Kelvin, helium fusion starts. And this reaction is called the triple alpha reaction because you need three alpha particles to get one carbon nucleus. Now we repeat the same story with helium. Helium is exhausted. Carbon and oxygen ash accumulates in a core. Core contracts. Helium burns in a shell. Hydrogen burns in a shell. Envelopes expands again. We get a second red giant or red supergiant, which is even larger and even more luminous star, for example, like the star Betelgeuse. The next stage will be carbon ignition. Carbon ignition needs 600 million degrees Kelvin. So not all the stars can achieve this high core temperature. If the star was originally less than 4 solar masses, then carbon and oxygen cannot burn and star dies. If the mass is greater than 4 solar masses, then carbon and oxygen can ignite. Carbon and oxygen thermonuclear reaction is a very complex reaction network, but the general rule is that heavy reactions need higher temperatures and they go faster. For example, we needed just 4 million degrees to ignite hydrogen. We need 120 million degrees to ignite helium, 600 million degrees to ignite carbon, and we need billions of degrees to ignite silicon. And the duration of this process is shorter and shorter. For example, in a 25 solar mass star, fusion of hydrogen to helium lasts for 7 million years, and the burning of silicon lasts just one day. So we end up with a hierarchy in the core. So fusion builds up heavier and heavier elements up to iron, and this is known as nucleosynthesis. But this reminds us awfully to another process that we call nucleosynthesis that happened in the early universe. So gravitational collapse can be viewed as an inverse Big Bang. So in a Big Bang, we have So the universe starts from high densities, and as the universe expands, the density goes down. Now in a gravitational collapse, actually we start from low densities, and densities increase as we are going down. And when we are talking about ordinary stars, then we are about this level, nucleosynthesis. But note what follows: QCD phase transition, then electroweak phase transition. Okay, so now the core is full of iron nuclei, undergoing some fusion and fission, but not generating enough new energy, which is needed to maintain the pressure. So the star suffers a sudden decrease in core pressure. And the star material basically goes into a free fall over the distances of 1 AU or more. And then that material crashes onto the core and mostly rebounds back into the space. And this is known as a type 2 supernova explosion. This is an artistic view of a supernova explosion. This is practically the best thing that I could find on the web. It looks nice. Impressive. Okay, let's go further. So the envelope goes out, it's blown out, but the core continues to shrink, collapse continues. Inverse beta decay reactions occur, and all of the protons and electrons are merged, leaving a core of almost entirely neutrons. So in most cases, the collapse will continue until stopped by neutron degeneracy, which is the packing limit of neutrons. So the core will end up a tightly packed ball of neutrons. So in less than a second of time, two solar masses worth of iron is smashed into a ball of neutrons of about 10 kilometers across. And this surviving object is called neutron star, as you all know. However, Fermi pressure cannot support stars heavier than 2.1 solar mass, which is known as the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov limit. So cores of stars heavier than this limit, have densities which are comparable with QCD phase transition density, which is about 100 MeV to the fourth. And this may lead to a quark star state where one cannot really distinguish between... of quarks. So there is no active source of energy. You just have quarks, and their pressure prevents the whole star from collapsing. So it's only pressure that keeps you from forming a black hole.
So I'm just saying, what's the difference between Fermi pressure of neutrons and Fermi pressure of quarks?
It's a different equation of state. Fermi pressure of quarks should be greater. I mean, you can ask the same question, what's the difference between Fermi pressure of electrons? In white dwarfs, you also have Fermi pressure, but it's also only Fermi pressure of electrons that prevents you from
collapsing. It's still poly.
Right, it's still the same thing.
Yeah.
Same physics is fundamental. The same.
As long as you have weakly coupled gas, then essentially they are the same. So I mean that's why Chandrasekhar mass is essentially the same for white dwarfs.
No, there is that small difference. I mean, yes, you have white dwarf, which is supported just by Fermi pressure of electrons, but then at higher densities, it's Fermi pressure of neutrons, so it's a little bit higher. Then further, you end up with quarks and Fermi pressure of quarks. But again, it's not that trivial, as you may want to point out. That's the next slide. So this slide just explains that instead of individual neutrons, you have a sea of quarks after the QCD phase transition.
What I'm trying to understand is this Oppenheimer bond, Oppenheimer Volkov.
That's for neutron star.
So that's assuming an equation of a state.
Right, for neutron star.
For neutron.
So quark stars could be...
Right. Or
right.
Okay. Also, I guess for quarks, you have 3 times 9 degrees of freedom for goodness.
Yeah. It seems that there is an uncertainty about the equation of a state of that neutron matter. But if that is strongly interacting.
But the point is good, because it turns out, I mean, these are pretty new results, that even quark stars, if you have three quark flavors, UDNS, Fermi pressure can support gravity. You don't collapse. When the densities become even higher than that, when you end up with more quark flavors, then you cannot find a static equilibrium. Then collapse cannot be stopped.
Why is
it goes for? Because again, so these are those precise calculations where you are calculating the equation of state and the Fermi pressure, which is provided by the number of quark species. So the pressure that you can provide with additional quark species is not enough to support the gravity, because in order to make another quark species, you have to increase the pressure so much, I mean that pressure, gravitational attraction so much, and the density and the temperature in the core, so that additional quark pressure is just not enough to support it.
So that cares about the quark masses, I guess.
Right, yes, okay. yes.
That's not an... That second statement is not obvious.
It's not obvious, yes.
You have to do a calculation.
Right, that's true. It's not obvious at all. Okay.
So is any of this story dependent on the exact nature of PCD phase transition?
That's the topic of modern research. People are still trying to calculate what is going on at the QCD phase transition. So there are various results. And we don't have a full picture of what is exactly going on, because we should end up in a superfluid state of quarks, yes?
So is there an estimate for the size of these things?
Yes. I don't know offhand, but this should be a little bit, so about 10 kilometers. About 10 kilometers.
Same as neutrons.
Very similar. You will see when we reach the... What is different is engine. What is different is the core. The outer layers are very similar to neutron star. You will see when we reach electron weak phase transition. Core will drastically change, but the outer layers are more or less the same.
Is there any positive evidence that these things exist at this point?
So that's why I separated the evolution from the protostar to neutron star to something that everybody agrees about, because we've observed neutron stars.
Yeah.
For quark stars, there are speculations, but still there is no observation.
There's no observation.
There is no. So that's why I divided it.
At some point, there was a claim a few years ago that you see something as two deaths.
Right. Yes, yeah. That's the only thing that you can...
Sorry.
Right.
Something, you observe something that if you try to fit it with the observation, with a model, it's two deaths to be a neutron star. So it must be maybe a quark star.
Yes. That's the only thing that you can do. You find something which violates the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkow limit, and you say, okay, this must be some new physics going on there.
Is that held up?
I don't remember. I want to say no, but I don't remember.
But are they roughly the same mass and size as a neutron star?
Several solar masses.
The neutron stars and white dwarfs are not the same. You can tell them apart.
Right, but this one is pretty much the same. So we'll see. Okay, so the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkow limit is 2.1 solar mass. Even when we go down to electro weak star, you will get 1.3 solar masses. So order of magnitude is the same. The differences are small. The difference, crucial difference, is the core. But core is small. Core is small. We'll come to that question. So this is the standard evolution. So this is the state of the art in the field. So Ogg discovered fire, Torlak invented the wheel, there is nothing left for us. So we thought that there is no interesting physics between the quark star and a black hole. Anything more dense or more massive than a quark star must end up being a black hole. However, we said that gravitational collapse can be viewed as an inverse Big Bang. So eventually the densities will reach 100 GeV to the fourth, which is the electroweak density. And then what will happen? The electroweak phase transition will happen. So as we said, ordinary stars are about this level. Then we have QCD phase transition. These are quark stars. So what is going on when we reach these densities? What will happen? Why is this important for the evolution of the star? Because we can take advantage of the standard model ultimate fuel, non-perturbative baryon number violating electroweak processes, which is conversion of quarks to leptons. Baryon number, as you know, is a global symmetry of the standard model Lagrangian, and baryonic current is perturbatively conserved. So divergence of it is zero, which means that quarks can appear and disappear only in pairs. However, on the quantum level, quantum corrections destroy, I'm sorry because of this. Okay, so what you should have seen here is the Adler-Bell-Jakive anomaly. So a baryonic number is perturbatively non-conserved in the standard model. So somehow this non-perturbative. So those are instanton processes which are suppressed at zero temperature. Okay, so you missed one slide, but everything will be explained on the following slides. So at zero temperature, these non-perturbative processes can occur only by quantum tunneling, and they are exponentially suppressed by a huge number. So, for example, proton can decay with these non-perturbative processes, but the lifetime of a proton is 10 to the 141 years. So it's absolutely negligible at zero temperature. But at the finite temperature, you can go over the barrier, classically, with the Boltzmann suppression factor. And this process is known as a sphaleron. Actually, that's not a process. It's a sphaleron is a quasi-particle, is a coherent state of many gauge and Higgs particles, but it's unstable, which means it can decay, but when it decays, it can violate the baryon number. So what's the sphaleron rate? At the final temperature, the sphaleron rate is exponentially suppressed by energy of the sphaleron or mass of the sphaleron over the temperature. And energy of the sphaleron below the electroweak phase transition is about 10 TeV, but above the electroweak phase transition is just T. It's proportional to temperature, which means that this exponential suppression factor disappears. So above the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, baryon number violating processes are essentially unsuppressed. They are over the barrier rather than tunneling processes.
What was TC again,
sir? Critical temperature, the temperature of phase transition. 100 GeV, electroweak.
Oh, it's the electroweak.
Yes, yes.
Sorry, can you trust the calculation?
Excuse me?
Can you trust the calculation?
Right. So your question is this is...
Right.
There are precise calculations because people did a lot of studies about this because of electroweak baryogenesis. People were beating on electroweak baryogenesis for quite a while, and these processes are very well understood. Sphaleron mass is about T at T greater than TC, which naively is going to tell you that they are not suppressed here, but you can do precise numerical calculations. Yeah? You can do precise numerical calculations and will show that at about T or 2 times T, they are really unsuppressed. I know that strictly speaking, this is not valid there, but both naively and then precisely you can show that the point is that you have a thermal bath. So it's not high energy, it's high temperature. The difference between high energy collisions, for example, at the LHC, is that you have only 2 particles with high energy, and they are not going to produce sphalerons. But high temperature means that you have a bunch of particles with high energy in a finite volume. So large energy in a finite volume tells you that you have a large temperature. And that's much better than high energy. In high energy, where you have just energy of the center of mass, you're colliding 2 particles, and you can have energy above the electroweak phase transition, but you are not going to induce baryon number violating processes. However, when you have high temperature, you have millions of particles with that energy beyond the electroweak phase transition, then you go over the barrier, and then you have those baryon number violating processes which are unsuppressed. So we call this process electroweak burning. So quarks can be effectively converted into leptons, and in this process, huge amounts of energy can be released. For example, a B minus L preserving interaction can convert 9 quarks into 3 anti-leptons. So the baryon number here is 1, but lepton is 0, and here lepton is minus 1, but baryon is 0, so B minus L is preserved. Of course, charge must be preserved. Charge is 0 here, charge is 0 here. So this is an allowed sphaleron process in which we start with 9 quarks and we get 3 antineutrinos. And now you see that small energy is not enough for sphaleron processes. You need high temperature. You need all of these particles to be very close together, so that the reaction is not suppressed at all. Okay? And in these temperatures, because the temperature of the medium is 100 GeV, you go from 9 to 3 particles, so typically this process can release 300 GeV per neutrino. So very, very energetic processes. B, you want to, okay, right, so let me go back. You have to preserve B minus L. So we still believe that B minus L is valid symmetry. You can violate B and L separately.
So it's forced on you by B minus L.
Excuse me?
It's forced
right,
on you
yes.
by B minus L.
It's forced by B minus L. Since you have mostly quarks, you end up with the anti-neutrinos. Okay. So what should the structure of the star look like? So first I will tell you, then we will find the solution. So we have electroweak core at the center, where electroweak symmetry breaking is restored, I mean symmetry above the electroweak symmetry breaking temperature. Then we have neutrino release shell. Then we have photon release shell. So electroweak core is the region where temperature is above the electroweak breaking scale. Neutrino release shell is a new thing. This thing doesn't exist in normal stars, because wherever, at whatever point you produce a neutrino, it can freely stream out of the star. But here, no. At these densities, the interactions of neutrinos, which is the meaning of electroweak unification, neutrinos become almost the same as electrons. So their interactions are very strong, and they are going to interact many, many times before they can leave the star. We'll calculate the mean Fourier path later. But the point will be that there will be a region inside the star where neutrinos are trapped, and outside they can freely stream.
So you're assuming that there is a step in the star.
Yeah, I will. All right, that's a very good question. I will address it. I will address it. I will address it. And then, of course, there is a photon release shell. That's the effective radius of the star. So photons are trapped inside, but from the photon release shell, they can freely stream into the neighborhood. How do we find a solution? What do we do? So we are solving Einstein's equations that describe the structure of the star. And these equations are known as Tolman-Oppenheimer Volkov equations. This is the explicit form of the Tolman-Oppenheimer Volkov equations. P is the total pressure, epsilon is the total energy density, mass is the mass of the star. So what you want to do is you want to get the profile for the pressure, P of R, profile for energy density, and profile of the mass, M of R. Now, if you, yeah, you have a question?
Sorry. So this is going to determine whether there's a stable static.
Not quite. Okay, let me, since this is the second time you're asking the same question, I will jump ahead. Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov equations are quasi-static equations. So you assume that there exists a quasi-equilibrium. They are not time-dependent equations. So
is there a way to check that as the star is imploding, that it ever gets close enough to time?
That's the part that we didn't do. But so I will tell you everything that we did, and that will be the part that is the crucial next step, to do time-dependent evolution. But then I will point out why this is not possible to do now. We found a solution, but the solution is Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov, which already assumes that you have quasi-equilibrium.
Yeah? So put another way, you claim you found an equilibrium solution to
right.
this equation.
Whether
it's stable or not is
yes,
another
yes,
story.
Yes.
But you have found at least an equilibrium solution to these equations at the
exactly.
electroweak scale.
Yes.
Is that
that's the point.
That's the point.
That's the point. We have a solution that describes these stars.
Its stability is not yet known.
Right. So the easiest thing to do is to supply the equation of state. If you supply equation of state, P as a function of density, then you can just numerically integrate this, and then you get the profile. Since we didn't want to assume equation of state, so we wanted to assume as little things as possible, we solved for it. So actually we did something a little bit more sophisticated. So we said that the pressure, energy density, and number density of particles can be approximated just from ideal gas distribution. And here we have distribution function, which is Fermi, Dirac for fermions and Bose-Einstein for bosons. The total pressure and total energy density, they will have contribution from each individual particle that you have in a star, in the medium. And you will have contribution from this bag model of nucleons. So this is the bag energy, but the bag energy is practically the QCD phase transition energy, 145 MeV. And now you can integrate Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov equations without assuming equation of state. And you can get these things independently. You can get P of R, M of R, epsilon of R, and then P of epsilon, equation of state. And it's not surprising that we got what we got. We got that pressure is one-third epsilon, which means this is the radiation equation of state, because at these temperatures, all of the particles are ultra-relativistic particles.
So that, is it just quarks and gluons?
It's electroweak phase transition. So everything, electroweak symmetry is restored. So inside, everything is massless, but outsides are quarks.
Is it just quarks and gluons? There's no leptons?
No, electrons. Electrons and neutrinos. Neutrinos are very important here. Neutrinos will carry most of the energy.
So you're assuming a soup of quarks,
yes,
and neutrinos. You're not and seeing
electrons.
How the transition
right.
to them carries out.
Yes.
You're assuming that there is a transition, and so you've got this core blob of quarks.
Right.
And just anti-neutrinos based on that earlier slide.
Okay, quarks will be falling down. So
yeah.
The shells of quark will be falling down. I will show you, because I haven't shown any calculations yet, I will show you that when these quarks reach the boundary of the core, they instantaneously get converted into anti-neutrinos.
Okay.
Well, right?
What's confusing me is that the previous stage to this is presumably the quark star,
yes,
which is just quarks and gluons.
Yes, now you have quarks
right.
and gluons falling onto the core and becoming anti-neutrinos.
Okay, so there's no other particle content in there.
And electrons too, but the neutrinos will be the most important, and photons.
So do you neglect
right.
electrons? And, that's what I'm trying to
do. What I'm doing here, we neglect it, but when you calculate the total energy content, yes, you do have electrons. But for energy transport through the star, in the first order, you will be mostly interested in neutrinos and photons. Observable signature. I mean, you cannot see electrons coming out from a distant astrophysical object. So you are mostly interested in photons and neutrons.
What about W's and Z's? Maybe
these are pretty heavy, so they should be. They should. We neglected W's and Z's in our calculation.
Why are they heavy though? The electrons and the
neutrons are. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Right, but they are pretty much. So we neglected them. So we think that the order of magnitude estimate will not change. And again, for observational signature, I mean, for what is coming out of the star, it's not going to be W plus minus and Z bosons.
Is your physics right around the phase transition temperature, or is it
the core is
transition temperature?
The core is exactly the phase transition, or a little bit above.
Then it won't be exactly massless.
So that it's not high above the phase transition, it's near the phase transition.
No, but the question is where? In the core, I agree, but outside, as you pointed out, it was a quark star. It used to be a quark star, so just quarks and gluons, nothing else. And then collapse continued. The collapse, so this is from other people's work. Collapse doesn't happen in a way that the whole ball crosses its own Schwarzschild radius. The densities increase gradually, so the densities increase at the center first.
So the equilibrium solution you found is a quark star outside with a little electroweak core
yes.
near the phase transition.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
yes.
that's the solution you found.
Yes.
Okay. So when you say near the phase transition, what are you talking about in temperatures compared? If I take T over TC, what sort of number am I talking about?
So we assume 100 GeV. We assume exactly at the phase transition. You can do it. You can do 200, 250. What is that you want to change?
Well,
some numbers will change for sure, but
definitely the mass of the W and Z and the mass of all the particles are a function of
yes,
T.
Yes, I agree.
So you seem to be assuming
we
that
didn't
these
take
masses
W's.
Are out of your spectrum and it's not clear.
No, we didn't take W's and Z's at all in the calculation. So we took quarks, we took electrons and neutrinos. So that's all that we did. So we neglected.
Did you also neglect all quark and all masses?
Right. At these energies, they're all ultra-relativistic, highly ultra-relativistic.
So you neglected all mass scales.
Right.
Neutrinos don't have because of mass, but because of charge concentration.
Yes, neutrinos have zero chemical potential outside, so they can freely stream.
You have five quark flavors then?
That's
too heavy. Scales.
Again, you're asking fine-tuning details. So, right, as I should have said here that all of them are ultra-relativistic except maybe for top quark. So for precise calculation, that includes all of those particles with masses around 100 GeV. I don't think that order of magnitude estimate will change. Your questions are in place. I'm just saying we didn't do that here because we didn't think that was terribly important.
Okay. But what also you didn't do, I'm not saying what you're doing is bad, but what you didn't do, which is what I thought you might have done earlier, you're not finding an equilibrium solution where the whole thing is that black blob in the
middle,
where the whole thing is like 10 times TC.
No.
You're rather finding the quark star surrounded by that little, or enclosing that little thing.
Yes, okay. That's the picture.
So if you're right at TC,
right,
then the numerical prefactor in the scalar on transition rate,
yes,
which is determined by very complicated functional determinant calculations,
right,
will be quite important. And it's not that well known in the standard model.
Yes, that is true.
So, and it would dictate the energy release, which is what you're saying, is leading to a quasi-stable solution.
I will show you.
So, how well do you think you know that numerical prefactor, and how sensitive as like a power law dependence to like cubic or quartic, how does it come into your equation?
In three or four slides, I'm going to come to your question. At the end, it doesn't matter. Because, okay, I will...
It's not going to matter.
No, it's not going to matter.
It's going to dictate the energy release. So that's okay.
Right. Right, right, okay. So, this is the solution, the numerical solution. So this is the pressure, energy density, and particle number density dependence on the radius of the star. So as you see, the solution is regular. So the structure that you cannot see is that at the beginning, so in the first several centimeters, the pressure and the energy density gradients are very small, which means that the energy density and pressure will be about flat. And that will be the core of the star. So the core will end where energy density drops below, significantly below the electroweak phase transition scale. How do you know what's the radius of the star? So radius of the star is the radius where pressure and energy drop to zero. And that radius is 8.2 kilometers. So a little bit less than neutron star. Neutron star is like 10 kilometers. What's the mass of the star? Remember when you solve Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkov, you get M of R. So M of this R tells you how much mass is concentrated there. So that's 1.3 solar masses. The solution is non-singular at the center, which means that this thing is not a black hole. So that was our primary worry. Can you reach these densities? Can you have a core with these densities and have a solution at all? Maybe there is no such solution. Maybe quark star is the last thing, and then there is nothing reasonable beyond it. Maybe there is no solution. Of course, it's not as beautiful as having an analytical solution, but we have numerical solution.
How do you ensure that there's a maximum density?
So you start with the initial condition. So you have numerical differential equations that you want to solve. You put initial condition that the energy density at the star is 100 GeV, and then you integrate it out.
So that's the only place that the electroweak physics comes in? Or is that anywhere
else? So why don't you let me finish? And then at the end you can ask me all these questions all over again if I haven't answered them.
I'm going to forget, that's the problem.
That's what's coming
on. Okay. No, I'm not going to be too long. Okay, I have like 15 more minutes. I will finish in 15 minutes. So one thing which I want to point out here, that unlike ordinary stars, particles propagating through the electroweak star will suffer a large gravitational redshift because the core is very dense. So this is the redshift factor inside the star. So remember when I showed you Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkov equations, we had the expression for GTT and GRR as a function of pressure and energy density. So GTT is going to give you the redshift. So this is the plot of the redshift of the star. So a particle with an original energy of 100 GeV near the center will carry away only 100 MeV as it leaves the surface. So that's one thing. Another thing is neutrino mean free path at these densities. Neutrino mean free path is proportional to the cross-section of interaction and the density of the surrounding material. And the cross-section is just electroweak. It's just standard model cross-section, but it grows with energy. So near the core, the mean free path for neutrinos will be 10 to the minus 14 meters, which means that neutrinos will interact many times before they leave the star. So if we estimate the neutrino luminosity at the core naively, and we write down that just, that's just sigma t to the core, and then the area, then we see that luminosity is 10 to the 53 ergs per second. And at this rate, it will take less than a second to release solar mass. And then this is not a new state in evolution of the star. It may be a good candidate for gamma ray bursts, but it's not a new phase in the evolution of the star. However, this is a severe overestimate because we didn't take GR effects into account, the redshift and time delay, and luminosity depends not only on the temperature and energy density, but also on their gradients. So we need the net outward flux of energy. So now this is the place when I'm trying to argue that the exact rate doesn't matter. So what's the maximal energy release rate? So free fall time of the quark shell into the electroweak burning core will maximize the energy release rate because the free fall time is going to minimize this delta T. So maximal release rate, energy release rate, will be 10 to the 27 MeV squared. Now you compare it with your calculation and put any numerical coefficient that you want. The difference is 7 orders of magnitude. So electroweak baryogenesis or baryodestruction rate is much faster than the rate at which I can burn quark, or the rate at which I can feed the core. So I can burn much more quarks than I can feed the core. See, that's the point that I was arguing. You agree with that? This is very important because if it wasn't like that, as the quark leach the electroweak core, if they are not instantaneously converted into antineutrinos, the infalling matter will pile up and maybe form a black hole. But this way, the picture is like this. Quarks are falling onto the electroweak core and instantaneously get converted into antineutrinos, and then antineutrinos fly away.
But they don't fly away.
No, they interact first many, many, many times, and then they diffuse.
Form a black hole. That's kind of the worry. If they cannot fly away. So the thing that I'm following, you convert them to neutrinos, but even neutrinos have a very short mean free path.
Right.
So they could still keep falling.
Right. That might be a possible scenario too. Then we model the relativistic transport of energy even better. Because Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkow equations just gave me the structure of the star. It didn't tell me where the location of neutrino sphere is. And it didn't give me important self-checks, cross-checks of the results that we did. So this is the relativistic transport of energy through the star. So you have energy release rate at infinity, that's the luminosity. And that's practically the same. Whatever you have it at the surface of the star, you have it at infinity as well. S is the energy flux, but at that point, R. And metric coefficients GTT and GRR tell you that you are dealing with highly curved space-time. GTT doesn't have a square root because it works twice. Energy release rate, so that's dE by dt. First you have a redshift in energy, then you have time delay. So that's why you don't have square root. But for GRR, you have a square root. And so if this thing gives you the models, the energy transport to the star, then you can do two things. First, you can plot the energy release rate versus neutrino release radius, which is the radius of neutrino sphere. So energy release rate increases with the radius of the neutrino release shell. And the maximum energy release shell you would get if it coincides with the surface of the star. But in that case, the luminosity, the energy release rate, will break down, will violate the limit that is coming from the quark shell free fall onto the electroweak core. And this implies that the neutrino release shell must be inside the star. It cannot be outside or coincide with the star. That's one thing. And the other thing that you can plot is neutrino energy at the surface of the core versus neutrino release radius. So higher energy release rate needs the source of higher energy. And energy of neutrinos therefore increases with the radius of release shell. However, the energy is already larger than 300 GeV if the release shell is 8.1 kilometers. And which means, and 300 GeV, I told you that's the typical neutrino that is coming out from the core. So the star cannot support energies larger than this. Maybe some other star, but not electroweak star. So if you cannot have neutrinos larger than this, then the energy, then the neutrino release shell should be at 8.1 kilometers. So now, if neutrino escape radius is really 8.1 kilometers, then the energy release rate should be 10 to the 24 MeV squared, which implies that it takes about 10 million years to release one solar mass. And that's the minimal lifetime of the electroweak star. So what did we neglect here? So we neglected the fact that some fraction of the energy is carried away by photons, since they have shorter mean free path. And we ignored the effects of energy transport due to convection. But we believe that order of magnitude estimate will not change there. What's the observational signature? So most of the energy is emitted in forms of neutrinos. But when quarks are transmuted into leptons, we get mostly antineutrinos. And most of the astrophysical objects that we know, they emit neutrinos, not antineutrinos. So a strong antineutrino emitter might be an electroweak star. The other thing is photoluminosity. We said that most of the energy is emitted in neutrinos, but significant percentage must be in photons. So it will be very important to calculate the photoluminosity, so whether these things are bright or dim. So this is an illustration that I found that might this is how electroweak star might look like.
So this was at BBC?
No.
It was on the news.
No. I just took an animation of a potential look of neutron star.
Ah, that's it.
Right.
I thought they were white.
Or quark star or whatever.
Oh, but I thought they were white. I don't know why.
But see, they are blue.
Oh, they're blue. Okay.
So, right, I think I skipped one slide. There was one slide. Right. So, we didn't do the full time-dependent analysis of the system, as I mentioned several times so far. But the core of the star is Earth mass compressed in a region of the size of an apple. So this is almost a black hole. And in this regime, most of the approximations that we use when studying gravitational collapse, homologous collapse, PPN, they fail. So we must use general relativity, full nonlinear general relativity with back reaction included. And this will be a very challenging task. The other question that somebody asked, I think Rob, is stability analysis. So the electroweak stars cannot be in a static equilibrium, like neutron stars. Neutron stars are dead. They don't have any source of energy, or a black hole. So it's much easier to check stability of a neutron star or a black hole than stability of this thing, because gravity is balanced by the gas pressure and also radiation pressure. And it's dynamic rather than static stability. So stability will be much more difficult to check in this case.
But do we actually know that? Could you have actually a static electroweak star? What's the problem?
Because you have, so you must have, the equilibrium will be reached when the energy in the form of infalling quarks is matched with the energy of outgoing neutrinos. So then the equilibrium is reached.
Yeah, but you could imagine a case where you have just like electroweak phase.
You mean the whole thing just electroweak, just core?
Yeah, just the core.
But then what's the reservoir? That thing will explode. You need to supply energy for quite amount of time. Quarks are reservoir.
No, it's like, same way that neutron stars are stable.
No, but they don't have active source. There is nothing burning there. Neutron stars are there forever.
But let's say you burn everything you had in your electroweak star. Then
that's the question number two. When does electroweak burning stop? So these will be important things to answer, and we don't have answers. So should the star spend at least 10 to the 7 years in the electroweak stage before it becomes a black hole? When does the burning stop? I mean, maybe you burn out all of the quarks and there is nothing left and black hole never forms. And so this will require much more detailed modeling of the star. And finally, I would finish with this. So what about, what's the next phase transition in the standard model? It's GOT phase transition. Can GOT stars exist? The answer, I think, is no, because the GOT feeling, right? The core of the GOT star must be microscopic. So first, it's unlikely to support the whole star, and unlikely to happen before the star crosses its own Schwarzschild radius. And I will conclude here. So electroweak star is an interesting new phase in stellar evolution. We found the solution and basic properties. Enormous energy is released at the core, but energy release rate is moderate at the surface, and the lifetime is at least 10 million years. What remains to be done is photoluminosity and other observational signature and full-time dependent analysis. And I will stop here. So now you can ask me all of the questions.
I guess I'm visually disoriented by your slide changing. So let's go back to that point, which is you're saying that it doesn't matter what the numerical coefficient is.
As long as it's like within 7 orders of magnitude. Because you cannot supply, you cannot feed the core as fast as you can burn the quarks. Electroweak spiral processes are very fast. So this is the maximal energy release rate when you assume that the quarks are just freely falling. No viscosity, nothing. So they are just freely falling onto the core. So this is the maximal energy release rate that can happen. And this is baryo destruction rate.
So it's like saying that you don't need to know to work out the structure of the sun, you don't need to know exactly what the fusion rate is, function of density or something.
Right.
How fast things are burning.
Right.
Well, I was just going to wonder a couple. So, is this why you couldn't imagine? It's still not fully clear to me, but would this be why you couldn't imagine an entire object being this electroweak blob because there's no fuel to feed it?
I mean, maybe something like okay. So when you collapse a massive object, so two things can happen: either the whole thing is uniformly collapsing.
Yeah.
Or the collapse is gradual. The highest density is at the center, then there is a density profile. And the density goes down as you're going up. So if the collapse is so quick, so that you squeeze practically the whole star into the densities of 100 GeV and higher, then maybe you have something like that. Electroweak star, which is completely within...
That's what I'm wondering. Is anything forbidden a pure electroweak star? No.
But then there is no... But then it will be just an explosion, or maybe not. Then you will have just a redshift.
Yeah.
Then you will go down by 6 orders, or maybe no, you have to recalculate the redshift, right. Then you will not have a burning,
yeah.
A stable burning with a reservoir.
Yeah.
You will have just an explosion, but since this thing is almost a black hole, it will be prolonged explosion. I mean, the observer outside would measure much
that's
more.
That's the whole point, it's almost.
Right.
That's the thing I want to see if it's there. So it seems to me like you know, some object where you're not at the electroweak phase transition, but you're 10 times above it or something. So I guess my crude idea is that it's hot enough for the neutrinos and quarks to just get converted into each other in a
right.
mess of equilibrium.
Right.
Is there something that obviously rules out that kind of object?
The way I understand collapse and those numerical simulations that support it, a collapse really happens by that way, that the density at the center is much greater than the density at the outskirts of the object. But the time scale of a collapse could be so quick that you can squeeze the whole thing very quickly into density of 100 GeV and higher. I don't think that's the generic situation. Generic situation will be with the core.
Well, sure, right, but right. I mean, you know, you want to know what's possible, right?
Right.
So it's not ruled out, I take your
Right. I don't see anything that can rule it out.
And one other thing, is it possible for a neutron star to have a quark star core, analogous to this in some sense?
But then nothing will change because, again, quarks, it is possible, of course. So we still don't know. In neutron stars, we don't know what the core is. So it could be it's a quark state of matter, but it doesn't change anything because quarks don't burn. I mean, it's just Fermi pressure.
Yeah, but then you could imagine a neutron star and a quark core and a...
Oh, right, an electric star, yeah. Some hybrid object, yes. Yeah. I haven't thought about it, but... I haven't thought about that, but why not?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Well,
what's dynamics that you go from there, where you can go from a quark star to your electric...
So that's the time-dependent solution that I said we don't have.
No, but even just not a solution, just... Like intuitively, I don't, because it's a static object which has no burning, static. It's a quark star, say it exists.
Good question. Two answers. Yes. Two questions. So the generic scenario that I had in mind is not that you go in stages. You just have too much mass so that you can stop at quark star. So it just collapses just all the way through. You just pass through all these stages and you end up with the electroweak star.
Okay, so you're not imagining a transition.
Right, I'm not imagining transition. However, there was some interesting work before. I mean, neutron stars can have their own things like earthquakes or starquakes or whatever. And in those non-linear regimes, you can have concentration of energy. So there were some interesting papers maybe from 80s, which they claimed that if in a neutron star that is already a stable neutron star and you would have thought it would be there forever, an earthquake happens, and energy gets concentrated at the core, and then you have some new exotic object. So that could be a transition from a neutron star into something like this. But it's not ordinary gravitational collapse, so you need something. You need an earthquake.
But you can have accretion
after that. You can have it, why not, right?
And the point is that if you just have accretion, then
you increase the mass, you go over the limit. Right, yes.
And
yes.
That's how, like, type 1 supernova.
Yes, that's type 1, yes.
That's from white dwarfs, I think, not from white dwarfs. But if I still, you could have it happening with neutrons.
Right, you can imagine that. Right.
Did you have an estimate for what the mass you have to be above to collapse directly to a black hole?
But again, we don't have that pathway, that path, that solution that goes from collapsing object to this. We don't have it. We have a solution that tells you if you start with 100 GeV at the center, the density goes to zero at 8 kilometers. Which means, and mass within these 8 kilometers is 1.3 solar masses. So you have the solution of the state. You don't have the initial state that made that solution.
So that's the analog of the Chandrasekhar mass or something for this, is 1.3 solar masses?
Right, yes. 1.3 solar masses with radius of... It is because this is a smaller and denser object. The object is smaller. It's denser, but it's also smaller.
Not that much smaller.
Right, not that much.
So just to understand this picture then, so you've got this core that's burning up quarks a lot faster than it's eating them.
Yes.
So you've got this quark supply outside.
Yes.
So what's going to happen again when the supply runs out? Like, that's the 10-7 year time. What happens to this thing?
Yeah, that's one of the questions that I listed.
So you really don't know what happens.
You don't know, because it will be interesting to know. Maybe this thing burns so efficiently that it's all of the quarks and nothing is left to make a black hole. Or maybe the burning stops but then you depleted most of the quark fuel, so you end up with a neutron star. The densities are lower, maybe. I mean, we don't have an answer. We don't know what happens. When does the burning stop, if ever?
Well, it's got to be. You've got infinitely many quarks, so it's got to stop sometime.
Yes, but the core may cool down, and maybe you lose electrolytic
temperature. Okay, but then it still stops.
And then it stops, and then you are left with whatever matter you have, but you don't have enough temperature to ignite the electrolytic phase transition again, so you just end up again with the object made of quarks. But much less than the initial object.
So then as these things burn, they shrink, right?
Right.
So you...
And maybe at certain point you you put up the fire at the center. Maybe.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not, right? Yes, but then I got a question at my own institution. But we know that black holes exist out there, so what do we mean that everything is burnt out? But then it's the question of initial conditions. I mean, if you're talking about a central galactical black hole, you form a black hole at the densities of 1 gram per centimeter cubed. If you're talking about black hole which is of Planck size, you form a black hole at Planck densities. So it may happen that this thing prevents black holes of that size, but it doesn't prevent any higher or smaller black holes from existing.
Well, or alternatively, as a really crazy idea, what if these super putative supermassive black holes are gigantic electroweak monsters that are,
right.
Is that ruled out? I mean, you presumably put an astrophysical
yes.
stellar mass, but from what you did with these equations, could you wildly change the numbers to get millions stellar mass objects that are these kinds
but
of
there
things?
Is one mass that he gets, so I don't know.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand from what he did.
Right.
But you would have put in, presumably, parameters that were, you know, I don't know.
See, we assumed as few things as we could. So we just set the initial condition at the center, and then we evolve the equations.
Yeah, but that will matter. What would it be? That radius has to care about the initial condition somehow.
Right,
so
right.
So one needs to ask, could there be gigantic
but 100 GeV is, if you want electroweak, then you put 100 GeV at the center.
Right.
So if you have much lower value, then it's not electroweak.
It's not burning. Right.
Yeah, well, it's much higher.
You can have much higher, no problem. Then I expect the radius to be small and density bigger, of course. That will be the question for God stars, whether God stars exist or not.
All right.
It doesn't matter that the electric phase transition isn't a phase transition, but a crossover, as best we know. And therefore, it doesn't have a well-defined critical temperature. Saying that also just doesn't matter.
Right, this will be the fine-tuning there. I mean, I think it doesn't matter. Once, all you care about are those Fallerian processes. Once they are not suppressed, this picture
well,
is done.
T to the fourth power, if I don't know T, then I get worried.
No,
also,
but I do have
the numerical coefficient we've been arguing about, I'm just remembering, it is uncertain by many orders of magnitude. People just, they just throw up their hands and just say, well, it could be 10 to the minus 1 or 10 to the minus 6 or something.
Right.
So those two things combined make me a little worried.
Okay, so you can apply absolutely the same story. You just say it's not 100 GeV, it's 1 TeV. That's it. At 1 TeV, Fallerian rate is certainly...
That'd be far lower than 100 GeV.
No, why lower? At 1 TeV, it should be higher.
At 1 TeV, it would be higher. Yeah.
Right, yes.
It could be lower than 100 GeV. I don't even know how to define a critical temperature. Crossover. Right.
Right. Right. Right. But it could be higher. It could be 5 times higher, no problem. The story still stands there.
How sensitive what he's doing is. You were saying before that you were right around the critical temperature.
No, that's what we did. It's a generic value. I'm not saying that for what I'm presenting here, it is crucial that you're exactly at the electronic phase transition. You could be higher. You cannot be lower, but you could be higher anywhere you want. You could be at 1 TeV. No problem. Maybe the rates become fast enough only at 1 TeV. Worst case scenario, you imagine. And then, okay, I'm applying everything at 1 TeV. And then probably the radius will not be 8 kilometers, it will be 6 kilometers or 4 or whatever.
If you had taken the fiducial value at the center to be a higher and higher temperature, would you have gotten a...
Smaller and smaller core.
But
denser but smaller.
But would you have gotten a higher or lower would that 1.3 solar masses have gone up?
I imagine lower. I don't know, but imagine lower because that's the only direction where you can go. I think, if I'm not wrong, that when you put... God scale phase transition, the core is 10 to the minus 30 centimeters. It's a disaster. That thing cannot support the whole star.
So on that note, So let's thank Dan again.
Thank you.
Dan will be here.